I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. This week, we're going from California to West Africa, to the Middle East, and all the way to the lunch you may have eaten at your desk yesterday. We've got the most powerful family in burritos, the flavors of soya spice, and America's Test Kitchen wonders, what's up with bowls? But first, what comes to mind when you hear the phrase Israeli food? Pomegranates, za'atar, grilled meats, great stuff, right? But what if you hear the words Palestinian food? For a lot of people, their mind goes blank. And Yasmin Khan wants to fill in that picture with phenomenal dishes like spiced roasted eggplant balls with cheese. So she went to Israel and Palestine and talked to cooks. And she wrote a book, Zaytun, that's driven by joyful deliciousness, but built on the complex emotions of life in conflict and occupation. She's here with us to talk about what writing that was like. Yasmin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So before you started writing cookbooks, you had a whole career as a lawyer, as a human rights campaigner. Why'd you switch to writing cookbooks?
Well, I think that one of the things that's always interested me throughout all my careers, mm-hmm. of which I've had many, is the power of storytelling and how storytelling can affect social change. And certainly when I was working on legal rights, you know, whether that was working with a family who'd, you know, lost a loved one because they'd been shot by the police, or if I'd been working with a human rights defender in the West Bank who'd been arrested without charge, the thread that brought both of those elements together was storytelling and telling people's stories, because I really realized that as a campaigner, the way to bring about change is to connect people to their hearts, to cultivate empathy, because that's where you can start having a conversation.
Yeah.
And in 2012, I went and spent a long time, well, a few months in Iran, where my mom's family are from. I'd just gone through quite a debilitating burnout following this human rights career. And it was there that I immersed myself in my family's kitchen, collecting stories of the revolutions, collecting stories of everyday life in Iran. And when I came back to the UK, I realized I was sitting on this treasure trove of stories that perhaps could shape an alternative view of how Iran is portrayed. And that's where the cookbook ideas came from.
Mm-hmm. You talked about being burnt out before working on human rights campaigns. And when we spoke earlier, you said, oh, where you really felt it was getting toxic for you was when you were working on Israel-Palestine issues. So how did it feel to then re-enter that place, even though you were doing it through food?
Oh, it felt many things. I think, you know, you have to be pretty privileged in your life to think that food isn't affected by politics. You know, for most people in the world, what they eat, how they grow their food, where their food is sold, it's inherently political, because our food system is tied up with our political system, our economic system. So I think, yeah, the bridge between food and politics has always seemed very natural for me. But it did feel unnatural going back to the West Bank. Can reconnecting with these people that I'd worked with, you know, 6-7 years ago, and being like, hi, I'm here to write a cookbook. And it was, you know, there was so many reactions to that. I mean, you know.
Did it feel frivolous?
I think to some people it felt confusing. I think sometimes to me it felt frivolous. But then at the same time, I think to many of the people I'd worked with, it was just like, oh, that's quite clever. That's a bit of a stealthy way to talk about an issue that can be quite indigestible to a lot of people. I think this is definitely a book that really pushed and stretched me in terms of my writing, in terms of my research, because, you know, how you find the appropriate tone to talk about Palestinian food and Palestinian culture and the situation in Israel and Palestine as an outsider is a sensitive one.
Yeah. How did you earn the trust of the people you wrote about?
You know, I'm a big believer in just the power of sitting down over a cup of tea and coffee and just explaining what you're doing and why.
Yeah.
I think my work experience over the last 20 years, in a way, spoke for itself. I was really clear. I was like, okay, I'm from the West. I'm a woman of Muslim origin. I want to challenge stereotypes of how the Muslim world is perceived. I want to show the beauty and joy that exists in your community and celebrate it.
Yeah.
And so once you say that, actually everyone's really up for it. You know, the thing is, people in the Middle East, I mean, especially in Palestinian communities, but like throughout the Middle East, you know, people feel a lot of pain and frustration and anger about how they're routinely depicted in the West. I mean, certainly in the last 20 years, the Middle East is never away from the headlines, but always for negative reasons. So any opportunity that people have to be like, oh, great, you don't want to talk to us about Hamas. You want to talk to us, you know,
about hummus.
You know, it's just like, great, you want to talk to us about our family's winery, or you want to talk to us about this incredible microbrewery that we've just opened up using, you know, Palestinian like orange peel and cilantro seeds to make like an incredible IPA. What, fantastic. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about Palestinian hip hop. You know, it was refreshing, actually. Yeah. And certainly I worked with this wonderful photographer whose name was Raya Manar. She was a 26-year-old Palestinian woman from Haifa, pretty punk, you know, kind of red hair, kind of tattooed, and a wonderful young artist. And so actually we would be going around together talking about the issues and we shared the same mission. So it was fun.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah.
A lot of it was fun.
Yeah.
I think that can get lost sometimes when I talk about the struggles. But it's an incredibly hospitable and warm place. And that isn't talked about.
Yeah. I mean, even you describing Raya, that's not an image that I associate. When you hear Palestine, you imagine what a Palestinian person looks like. You don't think of a red-haired punk tattooed artist, you know, like that's not the image that we get here in the States. And I was so moved by how often people in the book say to you something like, you know, I'm so glad that you are talking about how we can be happy. I'm so glad that you can talk about how we restore ourselves, you know, at the table.
Resilience definitely was a big theme for me in the book, and also when I was meeting people, you know, the resilience of the Palestinian spirit is simply extraordinary. And you saw it time and time again through producers and through farmers and through home cooks who were every day getting up and choosing to live and exist and cook and eat.
Yeah. But there's also a moment in the book that I thought was incredibly powerful. And it's sort of an open question that you leave. I want to get it right, so let me actually grab my copy. And there's a moment when you are, you know, conducting interviews and talking with people and cooking with folks, and you write that one woman said to you, "We are not clowns in a circus for you to come and watch and make research notes about and then make your name for writing down our suffering."
And still, 3 years on, you read it out loud and it just like, oh, it really, you know, it just felt like a ripple through my heart, actually. It was such a powerful thing and such an emotional thing and such a correct thing in so many ways for her to say.
Yeah.
You know, people in Palestinian communities have been so over-researched for 70 years. People keep going from the West, asking them to retell their stories, and like nothing changes on the ground. So that woman's anger and indignation was completely right. At the same time, I know as a journalist and as a writer that someone like me with a lot of privilege can actually impact and make a difference and change opinion by sharing these stories. And I think it's just about, for me, you know, I included that in the book because I wanted this issue to be something that other writers and journalists thought about.
Sure.
It's so easy in food media, especially in this Instagram world, to just travel around and be in a market and isn't it so beautiful? And here I am drinking some pomegranate juice and not really be aware of what's going on around you. So I felt actually it was my responsibility as a writer researching documents not to take away what ordinary Palestinians were saying. Of course, overwhelming response of people was positive. But I think it's always good when you are an outsider writing about another person's culture, to look at it sensitively.
Yeah, and to recognize exactly what you said. Like, you're actually asking them to do a form of work by telling you their story, right? Yeah. Like, you're asking them to share something with you.
Yeah.
And sometimes you deserve it and sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But now I have to say, you know, I also think it's really important to realize that there is and always will be and always should be a role for serious journalism and travel writing, and that that's okay.
For sure.
Throughout human history, that's how other cultures have learned about what's going on around the world. It's by writing about them.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty unapologetic now about the fact that it's also okay to do it.
Sure.
You know?
So, sure.
Yeah.
And you do it beautifully. And you mentioned Instagram. I have been following your book tour to the United States on Instagram for 5 weeks, 6 weeks.
A long time.
It's incredible. And I actually have to say, you know, I'm in this business. I work in publishing as well. It's really hard. What has that experience been like for you?
It's been incredible. I mean, I feel like a real honor, like, that people have responded so well to this book. And, you know, writing is such a solitary affair. You're sitting there in my pajamas most of the time, tapping away at my screen. So to be able to go out and talk about what I saw, to engage with people, you know, it's interesting. I expected myself to come out of the tour feeling quite exhausted because, you know, I was visiting so many places and I had so many events. But honestly, I felt so invigorated and energized by what I see as kind of a change that is happening across the USA on this issue.
Mm.
It's felt exciting. Like, okay, yes, let's talk about Palestinian food. It's okay to do that. It's okay to honor Palestine. And it's so wonderful to feel that I'm contributing a small amount to that.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much for coming in. I think what is the last actual interview you'll do for your tour?
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's Yasmin Khan, the author of Zaytoun, Recipes from the Palestinian Kitchen. And she left us with a recipe for eggplant and feta kefta, little double-roasted eggplant and cheese balls, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up...
If you go to a Nigerian wedding, it's just almost like comically absurd. The amount of people and the amount of food that is actually cooked.
So family style may be redundant as a descriptor
it's like,
for things.
You know, it's like extended family style in Nigeria.
That's Chef Shola Olunloyo with our friend Ali Buzari, talking about the glories of Nigerian food. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for curious cooks and eaters. The last time producer Lisa Morehouse had a story for us, it was about the Meat Le Café, a classic Cal-Mex restaurant that's the beating heart of San Bernardino's Mexican-American community since 1937. One day, a hot dog stand owner named Glenn Bell watched people line up for Meat Le Café's food, so he talked his way into the kitchen, asked them to show him their recipes, and promptly used them to open a place called Taco Bell. And now, 8 decades old, the Meat Le Café is still proudly dishing up their tacos, still a community meeting place, even though the family never saw any kind of royalties or credit for their invention. This time, though, Lisa's got a really different story of another family, the Ruizes. You may not know them, but they are burrito royalty, and I bet that you or your kids have eaten their food. Have a listen.
Oh, it's so many burritos!
Burritos! This is one of the plants owned by Ruiz Foods, the largest manufacturers of frozen burritos, in fact, all frozen Mexican food in the country. And this factory, it's like the Willy Wonka of Mexican food. Now, the company won't let me tell you much about what goes on in the factory. It's all a proprietary process. But what I can say is that I see thousands of burritos, quesadillas, and taquitos, most of which will be sold under the El Monterey brand. Over 1,600 people work here, and many fold or roll products by hand. Still, other products are folded incredibly by machine.
And so what's happening? Well, that's where it goes from tortilla.
Oh.
Where's the filling? Oh, is this bean and cheese?
All headed obediently down what looked like miles of conveyor belts toward a spiral freezer. Company co-founder Fred Ruiz tells me the family's originally from Chihuahua, Mexico, but fled during the Mexican Revolution when his father was just a boy. As landowners, the Ruiz family felt targeted.
My dad remembers everybody being piled into the car and in the middle of the night, and there was lots of guns and bombs going off.
They settled in Los Angeles. Fred Ruiz says his dad, Louis, was a born entrepreneur, selling feather dusters and then clothing door to door. The family moved to Tulare County in the 1950s when Louis Ruiz and his brothers started a tortilla business.
So I think what my dad realized at that time is that there's an opportunity to sell Mexican food in the San Joaquin Valley.
To learn more, I decided to talk to an expert.
I'm Gustavo Arellano. I'm the author of Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America.
He says the flour tortilla that defines a burrito is a northern Mexican staple.
The urban legend is that the first people who created the dish that were now called burritos were miners in Sonora.
In copper mines between Sonora, Mexico, and Arizona.
They would wrap all their food in these big flour tortillas.
And ride donkeys or burros down into the mines.
So they called these burritos, little burros.
He says burritos really entered the U.S. in the 1940s during the Bracero program, when tens of thousands of Mexican temporary agricultural workers came to the country. The American farm owners fed these workers rice and beans wrapped in flour tortillas. Eventually, the burrito entered the mainstream, starting with Taco Bell and Del Taco in the 60s and Chipotle in the 90s. But Mexican food has been in American grocery stores since the 1890s, first with canned tamales, beans, chili sauce.
Starting in the 1930s, you have a man named George Ashley. He starts putting tortillas in a can.
Not all, but most of these food producers were white. Most of their customers were white people who lived near Mexican Americans and their food.
Once Americans taste Mexican food, they need it, and it becomes a part of their life, and they're going to try to replicate it at home one way or another.
And that's the environment in which Louis and Fred Ruiz started their business in the 1960s. They had a primed customer base in the racially diverse Central Valley and the perfect muse, mom. While Fred and his dad developed recipes for their first products, his mom worked at a shoe store in downtown Tulare.
I would be working on some sauce, and it just didn't taste right, so I would put it in a little dish, and I'd drive over to the store, and I'm there, I've got, you know, sauce all over my t-shirt, and I smell like an enchilada. I said, Mom, taste this, and she would tell me, well, it just needed a little more oregano, a little more garlic.
In fact, the test kitchen is still called Rosie's Culinary Center. Kim Ruiz Beck says her grandfather served as both delivery man and sales guy.
He would drive the truck, pull in, deliver all the product in the back of the grocery store, and then he would drive around the front and he would change into a suit.
And meet with the manager to try to make more sales. Ruiz Foods grew to be a top Latino-owned business, but Fred Ruiz and his dad started the company before major advances in civil rights.
There were some challenges, you know, just growing up as a kid, being Mexican. You know, I asked, you know, this girl if she could go on a date one time, and she says no, she couldn't because I was Mexican. Her dad wouldn't let her date Mexicans. And in business, you know, yeah, you know, there were some challenges that we had to overcome. Some people didn't believe, you know, that we were going to grow our business.
But Kim Ruiz Beck says by the 1980s, a new piece of technology transformed the business, the microwave.
Every home has a microwave. I mean, that really is, you know, the key to our product success.
Ruiz Foods started growing into the multi-million dollar a year business it is today. For the company to stay on top, the family says they've had to innovate.
That's why I give my kids El Monterey breakfast burritos.
They're adding breakfast really items, fusion foods, and something called tornadoes. They're like flautas or taquitos, developed specifically to fit on convenience store roller grills, the ones that usually hold hot dogs. But their number one retail product is still a bag of 8 frozen burritos.
My whole life, this is all I know. All I know is burritos.
Now the chairwoman, Kim Ruiz Beck, started working at her family's company 40 years ago.
This is all I ever wanted. So proud of my dad and my grandpa. I just, you know, wanted to be a part of this business. And, you know, I guess it's not real professional, sorry, you know, but I love this business. I love what they've created. I love what we do in the community.
Through lots of philanthropy. And she says she loves knowing that they're reaching so many people through food. At a town park a mile away, I ask a group of teenagers on skateboards about Ruiz Foods. They've got friends and family who work at the factory and say, though they prefer homemade Mexican food, they eat El Monterey burritos for convenience and the low price tag. An 8-pack of bean and cheese burritos costs under $4 compared to other convenience store fare.
A bag of chips is like $1.69.
And a soda is $1, so it's like $3.
And what's clear, talking to these guys basically in the shadow of the Ruiz Foods factory, is their products are in a lot of our lives, whether we know it or not.
I never tried it.
You never ate it?
I never ate Ruiz food. Well,
I know you have because don't they package?
Blue burritos?
Yeah, they package the El Monte burritos, yeah? I think. Yeah.
I like them. I like the green packet.
What's in the green packet?
Chile verde and the meat and beans. It's the best one.
These burritos are everywhere, but their roots are right here in the Central Valley.
Lisa Morehouse is the creator of the James Beard Award-nominated radio series and podcast, California Foodways. And look, I have definitely eaten my share of frozen chimichangas in my day, but for those of you who are up to making a burrito, the chef Roberto Satibanez has a super simple, super delicious recipe for potato and chorizo tacos, which I bet would be great wrapped up in a giant flour tortilla. You can get the recipe at splendidtable.org. Ali Buzari is one of the smartest people in food. I mean, he literally has a PhD in food biochemistry and is a trained chef. But what's more important is that he's one of the most curious people in food. And when he told us he wanted to learn about Nigerian cuisine from the chef Shola Olumloyo, we knew we had to get them talking. Shola's lived all over the world and is a chef who's dazzled Philadelphia and the blogosphere for almost a decade with his super modern technique, but he's also dug deep to the culinary traditions of his family's native Nigeria. Here's their conversation.
Hey Shola, welcome. I'm so excited that we got an excuse to talk to each other on microphones.
Well, thank you for having me. This is exciting.
So we're here to dive into Nigerian food specifically, because this is something that until I met you and we started chatting, I had no understanding of this incredibly deep food culture of almost 200 million people. And before we get into the deep stuff, can you give us just like the stereotypical like paella, ramen, Belgian waffle level of what foods might commonly serve as shorthand for Nigerian cuisine?
Well, it's funny that you use those specific examples because there are, in fact, I think in every culture and specifically in Nigeria, you know, ceremonial rice dishes are almost ubiquitous to every culture and every cuisine. From paellas to rishtafels to, you know, risottos and all those things, pilafs. In Nigeria, they have a specific dish, jollof rice, which is a big amalgam of rice and vegetables and meats. It's almost more directly, genealogically similar to like a Valencia paella, you see? There are all kinds of fritters that would be like, you know, donut, savory or sweet. Puff puff is named for one, which is actually kind of maybe a derivative English, you know, double puff. It's just called a puff puff. And then there's a bean fritter, which is called akara, which is beans that have been soaked, skins removed, rubbed, added, onions, chilies. It's a more complex and I think more delicious form of what would be a falafel, you see. And so all those things exist. We don't have a noodle culture. But we have a rice and other starches, cassava, you know, fermented, other grains that are ground into pulses and other things, yeah.
So it sounds like already there's rice, there's legumes, you mentioned chilies. It sounds like there's a lot going on, there's a lot of staples, and I know just from Wikipedia that Nigeria is very agriculturally robust, and then it kind of spans everything from the lower deserty savanna portion of the Sahara all the way into, I think, tropical rainforests and coasts, right? There's a lot going
absolutely.
On in terms of ingredients.
Yes. By the time you go down to the Niger Delta, the area in the south, southwest, It's very rich, lush territory. There's tons of cocoa growing among all the vegetation. So yeah, we have about five or six microclimates in Nigeria.
And just untold ingredients coming from all of those places.
Absolutely. You know, even though indigenously everyone's using it in the established traditional pathways, you know, my sort of view in the last few years and more so now is to sort of see how all those ingredients and flavors are able to be translated into the modern context without losing their soul.
So where are the test kitchens of Nigeria? Like, where are all of these ideas forged? Is there a long history of cooking in royal courts, or is there a lot of street food? Are family cooks more prominent than restaurant cooks in kind of the Nigerian culinary consciousness?
Nigeria's culinary consciousness hasn't really developed a kind of a culinary class, you know, as you've seen in other countries, you know, with food networks and, you know, Michelin stars and all those things. It's a very native cuisine. In fact, in many ways, Nigeria hasn't had royal courts per se like you would see in India or Egypt or places like that. The food is a intrinsic family experience. It's about eating dinner together on Sundays. It's about weddings. It's about births. It's about, you know, christenings. All the ceremonial aspects of life and religion are the primary drivers of ceremonial cuisine in Nigeria as opposed to actual ceremony. You know, maybe a little bit Christmas, New Year's, but otherwise they're mostly human stories and feeding the people who are part of them, their friends and their attendees. You know, I think if you go to a Nigerian wedding, it's just almost like comically absurd, the amount of people and the amount of food that is actually cooked.
So family style may be redundant as a descriptor
for things. You know, it's like extended family style in Nigeria.
That's amazing.
You know, dinner with like 100 people, you know.
Yeah.
Cauldrons, yeah.
I love that. So, Shola, I love talking to you because the first time we met, you introduced me to some of these ideas inherent to Nigerian food in a way that usually takes people a long time to get to. So rather than, here are the five mother sauces of Nigeria and they must be used as prescribed, blah, 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 you immediately jumped into, like, here's 10 different uses that I just thought of for peanut flour that we use as a thickener. Here's a marinade that's similar to Mexican adobo. You're incredibly forthcoming in giving immediate and very approachable context. Is that a Nigerian thing or just a Shola thing? Like, are Nigerians as protective as how things, quote unquote, should be as Italians might be with their DOP pizzas?
Well, yeah, so it is the same. And that's funny you say, because I just had this conversation in Italy after roaming around for a month. Nigerians are both very nationalistic and want to preserve the native food as what it is. You know, you don't, not too many changes, maybe a different vessel. However, you know, people are now becoming aware for the future of a cuisine to evolve, you have to be subject to some variation and experimentation. And people are now only becoming a bit more open to the use of Nigerian ingredients in less traditional forms, as opposed to just always making the same dish. But you're still able to make delicious food that speaks to the soul of Nigeria. It happens to end up in a middle gray area where Nigerians are like, well, this isn't really Nigerian. And then Westerners are like, I've never had anything like this before. So even if it's not Nigerian, you know, it's new to me. It's really new to us, you know. That gray area is a ripe landscape of creativity for me. And I kind of take ingredients in general as a line item list of, you know, items with, you know, various attributes, astringency, saltiness, funk, umami. So I can still stay and weave within a certain cuisine something interesting that is not traditional. And in order for me to explain to outsiders, and by that I mean like non-Nigerians, Westerners, like how do I get this food, you know, without removing their preconceived notions of the food of Black Africa, I just had to come up with some ideas like, okay, so you have things like this. It's just that the elements of flavor are slightly different. Jollof rice is basically a paella. Akara is basically a falafel. Ifeanyi nixtamalized white beans in Nigeria, which I have done, strangely, and it's beautiful. It works great. Hmm. It can end up being like almost like something you fry into a latke, you know? So there are many ways to explain. It's the words and the origin that's intimidating. So for me, if I can find a familiar item that allows people to understand what I'm talking about, I think it works that way.
And you clearly have a pretty amazing gift for thrumming on these threads that link countries and cultures and food ways. Can you help us jump into these higher levels of thinking where we can just start to incorporate Nigerian food and ideas into our daily lives quicker? Like, would you mind sharing maybe one or two gateways, books, restaurants, go-to techniques or ingredients that listeners could incorporate into their lives to get a Nigerian starter kit?
Well, so there's nothing really ultimately simple that you can do and just make. One of the most common street snacks in Nigeria is suya, S-U-Y-A. And suya is a basically grilled beef. It's mostly beef on a stick, like almost like a kebab of some sort. And it's cooked in wood and charcoal. So now, I'm sure you can go into any major American city, like, you know, definitely in Philadelphia, definitely in New York, where there are West African stores. There are lots in D.C. And you can just go buy a bag of suya spice. And it's just a powder. It's peanut-based. Word of warning. If you're allergic to peanuts, you do not want to eat this. You cut meat into thin strips. You dust it heavily with the flour. If you want to give it a bit more luxury like I do, I spray it with a little bit of peanut oil. And just grill it directly on skewers, on a rack with charcoal or wood. Even if you do it in your oven, it would be quite delicious. But the primal flavors of meat and, you know, obviously not natural fire makes it what it is in Nigeria. Even in the most, it's street food. In the most basic shacks, it's always cooked on wood or charcoal, you know, because gas is a commodity. Strangely for an OPEC producing country.
So it sounds like suya might be a perfect gateway drug for getting into Nigerian cooking for an avid home cook. So Shola, can you explain to us a little bit about what suya is and what the keys are to doing it right?
Well, suya is all about the spice, and it actually involves a process that's actually unique to Nigeria. Like, nobody else does it in the world. And the process is that peanuts are mashed with a mortar and pestle, and always non-mechanically with them. They're mashed till they turn into a very thick paste. It takes quite a bit of effort. And then they're put in almost like muslin, a cloth. And it is squeezed for a significant amount of time till as much of the oil comes out as possible. And when that is done, the peanut meal that's left has a little bit of water mixed into it. It is formed into little patties. And then it is fried. And it becomes this crusty little, you know, flat pellets. That is something in Africa referred to as kuli kuli, K-U-L-I-K-U-L-I. And that is what forms the basis of the spice mix. So to that, other native peppers, chilies, garlic, onion are added, you know, and that becomes the basis of the suya spice. And it has a very particular flavor. It's an interesting fermented peanut flavor, but it is still peanut nonetheless. And that is simply just dusted on meat with a little salt, and it is grilled. That's it. Most of the engineering and the work is in the production of the spice. Otherwise, it's just, you know, dip meat in it and grill it, yeah.
So the actual home implementation of the suya spice is like cooking with miso, right, where there's a process leading up to you opening the bag in a lot
exactly.
of instances.
Exactly. I would not, you cannot make kuli kuli at home. You just can't. No Nigerians make it at home. You should go to a store and buy it.
Shola, thank you so much for coming on. This was fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Shola Olunloyo is the chef owner of Studio Kitchen in Philadelphia. And our contributor, Ali Buzari, is the author of Ingredient, Unveiling the Essential Elements of Food. Coming up...
Food bowls make me suspicious. I don't understand why there is a need to have all those ingredients touching each other in one place. And somehow, no matter what is going into the bowl, whether it's poke or falafel, they all come out tasting exactly the same.
America's Test Kitchen's podcast Proof takes on the bowl trend, because putting food in bowls is a trend. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So a while back, a friend was telling me that she's really not into bowls. And what she really meant was that she's confused by the bowl thing. You know what I mean? Like, why does every restaurant now have a dish called a bowl? Haven't people been eating out of bowls since there were bowls? Like, how does a whole category of dish suddenly show up in the late 20-teens called bowls? Well, America's Test Kitchen has wondered the same thing, and in their podcast Proof, Harry Wood tries to get to the bottom of the mystery.
The world's been eating food out of bowls since time immemorial, but the idea of the food bowl is a distinctly modern parable of 21st century desire for ease and ultra-customizability. Pick your meat, add a grain, throw in some veggies, a topping or two, a dollop of sauce, slop it all into a compostable container, and you're good to go. Do I think food bowls are a suspiciously simple, borderline, culturally insensitive, inexplicably popular food phenomenon? Yes. Did I eat a burrito bowl for dinner yesterday, and will I eat a poke bowl for lunch today? Also, yes. It's undeniable. Bowl craziness is in full swing.
While other burger places serve the same old stuff, I'm the only one who has the bowls to serve something different. I mean, just look at my teriyaki bowls.
Feast your eyes on new Banquet Mega Bowls, and you're looking at a mouthful.
Taco Bell's new Cantina Bowl. You'll love it, or we'll replace it with something you do. Guaranteed.
What's up with this bowl craze?
This is a Buddha bowl.
A Lomi Lomi Salmon Poke Bowl.
Hey, yo, like, we're gonna pop with a burrito bowl.
With us. I would be very happy if I ate food out of a bowl for the rest of my life.
This idea all started, as most things in my life do, as a conversation with my mom.
Hi, Harry.
My mom works in Midtown, New York, and one day when we were thinking about grabbing lunch, I mentioned the idea of heading to pick up a bowl from somewhere. And she wasn't exactly excited by the prospect. And when I asked her why, she opened my eyes.
Food bowls make me suspicious. I don't understand why there is a need to have all those ingredients touching each other in one place. And it seems that every restaurant now feels the need to have a bowl bar. And somehow, no matter what is going into the bowl, whether it's poke or falafel or organic beets or butternut squash, somehow they all come out tasting exactly the same.
Okay, at first, I thought she was being like a little ridiculous. I mean, I eat bowls all the time. They're cheap, they're quick, they hit all the right notes. But the more I thought about what she said, the more I started to think, yeah, it is suspicious. Bowls are everywhere and they just keep popping up more and more and more. And as I went deeper, I thought, Maybe this whole thing is a conspiracy. Maybe eating bowls is exactly what they want us to do. It starts with a nice, warm, happy, aesthetically pleasing mix of all our favorite foods in one bowl. Then it's all our favorite foods in one food. Then before we know it, we're all happily drinking our government-supplied Nutrimush through a straw. They all taste the same, so we are the same. They all taste the same, so we are the same. I should clarify for the listeners at home, I don't actually think that our government is trying to control our minds through the use of grilled chicken and quinoa. Frankly, I doubt they are that clever, but I do think food bowls are super weird. Bowls have been around for almost as long as society itself has been around. So it seems strange to me from the start that something that's, you know, tens of thousands of years old is suddenly in the last 10 years become a huge phenomenon. But I actually think it makes sense why certain parts of how society's been shaping and shifting in the past decade or so has led to food bowls suddenly becoming this like hot new thing. And to get to the bottom of the bowl, I knew that I had to go straight to the source, the place where it all began. Are you guys hearing all this? The muted chatter, the sizzling of the grill, the backing track of generic mid-90s to early 2000s soft rock. That's right. You probably know where I am. I am in a Chipotle right now. Yeah, that's right. I am currently sitting inside the inner sanctum, a busy Chipotle on 34th Street in Manhattan. And I am surrounded by sheeple just chowing down on their bowls, face deep in their carnitas and their barbacoa, not even stopping to think for a second about why they're eating what they're eating. You know, like, come on. I mean, okay, yes, I am also eating a burrito bowl, but like I'm doing it in a woke way. You know, like I'm aware of what I'm doing. Like, in my defense, I have always eaten Chipotle burrito bowls, okay? I mean, that's where it all started for me. I still remember my first Chipotle burrito bowl. I was 11 years old, and a brand new restaurant had just opened next to the Staples in the strip mall in my hometown, where it quickly became a fixture of my family's Friday night takeout plans. It was reliable, quasi-Mexican food that didn't break the bank. It was a magical place where chips were lime-hinted, tortillas were warm, and guac was plentiful at a price. Restaurant data collector Technomic showed that from 2012 to 2017, food bowls saw an almost 30% increase in menu prevalence at restaurants nationwide. But while food bowls started to rise in popularity in the 2010s, Chipotle was way ahead of the game. They first started selling their burrito bowls in 2003, and the bowls quickly began to outsell Chipotle's burritos on the menu.
People have been eating bowls for a long, long time. But when you look at the scale that Chipotle kind of introduced them to America, you could say that this trend started with Chipotle.
That's Chad Browse, Chipotle's research and development chef. He's worked in some of the best restaurants in the world, Daniel, Per Se, El Bulli, but even he remembers his first burrito bowl.
I was working as a commis in New York City at a really fancy restaurant by Daniel Boulud. And Chipotle had just, I believe they just entered the New York market. So they were doing a little bit of promos and they came to our restaurant and did family meal for us. And I remember seeing this giant pile of silver wrapped burritos, but then next to it, burrito bowls. And that was my first experience. I loved them.
Chad works out of Newport Beach, and every week he travels around to try different foods in the SoCal area to make sure he's keeping up with the trends and staying ahead of what Chipotle should be seeing coming on the horizon. And it's no surprise that Southern California is a great place to keep up with what might be next for the food bowl. A lot of the trends that started in Southern California, the keto diet, the paleo diet, inspired the kind of avoidance of the tortilla that led to the inception of the food bowl in the first place.
So the idea stems from simply watching our customers. Steve Ells, our founder and the brainchild behind all of Chipotle here, he was in stores and just recognizing that people were changing the way they were eating in our stores. Lots of times they would either unwrap a burrito and then use a spoon or a fork to kind of devour the insides, or they would even just have us make it into the lined bowl that we generally pass the burritos on. It was just kind of watching how people want to eat and then adapting ourselves to that, you know, versus the other way around, where we'd tell people what to eat. So I think it was just a really good example of being in touch with your market.
And as the burrito bowl began its steep ascent, the numbers made it clear. Chipotle had hit on something bigger than just a country's love of affordable, fast casual Mexican food. This trend was going to be bigger and wider than just Chipotle alone could contain.
A chicken burrito bowl is definitely more popular than a chicken burrito. It's funny like that. We sell more bowls than burritos actually here at Chipotle.
I am still feeling a little conspiracy theory-y about bowls. I mean, I have a better understanding of the forces behind where bowls came from, but why bowls? What is it about the food bowl that has so captured our collective imaginations? Does the comforting warmth remind us of childhood dinners? Are we unconsciously attracted to the sensual curve of a good bowl? That sounds a little far-fetched and Freudian to me. But Michael Whiteman, restaurant consultant for the firm Baum & Whiteman, doesn't think so.
There's something spiritual about a bowl that doesn't exist on a plate. And it's also sensual. It has to do with being able to cup a bowl in your hand like a Buddha. And you notice that many places are calling them Buddha bowls because they're all vegetarian. But it's not because of the vegetarian. It's the sensual experience of having a bowl in your hand that transcends anything you can get from having a sandwich in your other hand.
So maybe we are feeling okay with our poke, getting naughty with our basmati, yeah?
One of the reasons that bowls have become so popular doesn't have to do with identity or health at all. I think it has to do with comfort.
Dara Goldstein is a cookbook writer and a professor who taught food studies and Russian literature at Williams College for 34 years. She's also the founder of Gastronomica, a major food and culture journal.
Something about eating food out of a bowl. I'm a porridge lover. I know a lot of people aren't. They think of it as Dickensian gruel. But if you think of a really wonderfully warming bowl of oatmeal or a bowl of soup, which is kind of the ultimate comfort food, the bowl is intrinsically a comforting shape, as opposed to, say, the kind of plates that you often encounter in cutting-edge restaurants that are all about angles and strange geometric forms. And you don't feel that you embrace the food in the same way. So I think we have to think about that comfort aspect of them too.
Okay, so apparently Dr. Goldstein would have me believe that even the very shape of a bowl is all part of some conspiracy to lull me into this state of culinary complacency. Shameless. But I had a feeling we were just scraping the surface of the bowl. We had to get down to the meat and the grain, which was probably farro. Honestly, I'm still not quite sure how I feel about farro, but I digress.
That was an excerpt from Proof, podcast by America's Test Kitchen. And to hear Harry get to the bottom of the bowl, listen to the full episode. He gets into all kinds of theories about what fuels our collective obsession with them. And I will throw my theory into the ring. I think it's because this is how most cultures eat anyway. Because if you're eating out of a bowl, right, chances are the base of the meal is rice or grains or soup or noodles with some kind of topping, which means you're eating with a spoon or fork or chopsticks. The point is, you're not eating a giant hunk of meat that you need to cut with a knife. And so it automatically kind of helps you balance your diet, right? More grains and vegetables, a little less meat, and you get to shovel food into your face, which just feels awesome. Like, rah, rah, rah. Like, why do you not want to do that all the time? Anyway, listen to Proof wherever you get your podcasts. And we've also got a few recipes for, there really is no other word for it, bowls from America's Test Kitchen. Check them out. They're at splendidtable.org. And speaking of podcasts, we have a new one too. I'm so psyched to tell you about Weeknight Kitchen with the one, the only, Melissa Clark. Melissa is a New York Times food columnist, award-winning author of a ton of cookbooks, and every episode is devoted to one recipe that you're going to want to make the minute you get home from work. It comes out in May. Find it, love it, leave us a review, and that is our show for this week. Until next time, remember to eat well, drink well, and please tip well. Be sure to go to splendidtable.org to get information on anything you ever hear here. Look around our recipe collection, sign up for our weekly email newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and subscribe to our podcast. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell, Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director, Erica Romero is our associate producer, Chip Walton is our digital producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.